You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Since the Vietnam era, media access to war zones has been steadily curtailed, and the notion of precision warfare has become commonplace. The reality of what it's actually like on the battlefield has been masked by euphemisms such as collateral damage, and the use of so-called smart bombs has supposedly led to fewer civilian casualties. But according to University of New Hampshire's Professor Mark Harold, precision warfare is a fallacy. During the bombing of Afghanistan, Harold spent extensive time documenting civilian casualties, and he fears more loss of life should a new war begin in Iraq.
Let me just say something first about the precision-guided munitions. You see, this is absolutely critical for the Bush regime. They must sell, they must market to the American public the idea that we now have precision-guided munitions, and therefore we will only kill the bad guys, and none of the good people will be killed, because, and this I think is so critical, because a casualty-rich war, a war in which the U.S. takes casualties in the post-Vietnam era, is simply politically unacceptable. So we have these new kind of wars, which began with the first Iraq war of 1991, where we are now using PGMs. And my work for the past year has been to challenge that, fight that idea, because I think the future is one of endless war, Mr. Bush has told us, in no uncertain terms. And if we have a future of endless war, then I think it's very important that we get the idea and the details, the nitty-gritty of the human cost of war out in the public discussion. This has to be out there. So this is important. A political scientist, Douglas Loomis, said it all very well. Air bombardment is the terrorism of the rich. One of the senior people working for the Times of London just a few days ago said about Afghanistan, Afghanistan was a show of retaliative firepower. And it certainly was a show of retaliative firepower. Unfortunately, the American general public knows relatively little about what happened on the ground in Afghanistan, and that's to what I've devoted a significant part of my life during the past year to try to expose what was happening on the ground. So, maybe just to start, October 19th, a year ago, what was happening on the ground? Here's what was happening. The Kala-e-Wakil district near Kabul airport was hit in the early morning by three waves of U.S. planes. 10 people died. The Sarai Shamali informal market in northern Kabul was hit, and a bomb fell in the middle of the informal market, killing 12 people, wounding scores of others. In Kandahar, a government building near the shopping area of the central Madad district was hit. 20 people died. We began carpet bombing the Shamali Plain area on October 19th. This was celebrated in the American military press, and we can read about that. I can give you many citations. And last but not least, we began bombing the area up near the border with Tajikistan called Dasht-e-Kala and around there. This just for starters. This is what was happening a year ago. Did any of that get reported in the mainstream corporate press? Of course not. We have to market the idea of a clean war in which there are no civilian casualties or very, very, very few. And we sort of sanitize the whole thing by saying, well, that's collateral damage. You know, that's we sanitize it. When we look at the past major U.S. air wars, there are basically seven of them. They fall into three clusters in terms of civilian deaths. And interestingly, the Iraqi Gulf War had the lowest ratio of civilians killed per tonnage of bombs dropped. So the Iraqi war campaign of 1991 was not a bombing campaign which caused a large number of civilian deaths. The second group is Vietnam and the various campaigns in Vietnam, and Serbia. The most devastating is the third group, and the third group comprises Laos and Cambodia and Afghanistan. So this has been a particularly destructive war, air war, in terms of civilian deaths compared with most of the previous air wars, with the exception of Laos and Cambodia. This is, again, something which the mainstream corporate press never tells you, never talks about, and it certainly isn't something which Mr. Rumsfeld tells you, nor will the Bush administration in its political divisions, the State Department and the like. There are a lot of differences between the air wars of Afghanistan and Iraq. Afghanistan is basically what we call a low bombing intensity, meaning relatively few planes flying per day, but a high civilian casualty intensity war. Iraq is exactly the reverse. Iraq is a high bombing intensity, an enormous number of planes in the sky per day, up around 1,500 as compared to less than 80 in Afghanistan, but it is a low civilian casualty intensity warfare. I think the coming war in Iraq will be quite different. Between October 7th and April 4th, the U.S. dropped about 22,000 bombs and missiles upon Afghanistan. A reasonable figure, a conservative figure, is that about 3,500 bombs really missed their target. This in a war of, you know, precision-guided bombs. Now, when one of these bombs misses its target, given where they were being dropped, they're going to kill people. And they're going to kill a lot of people. So when I say that minimum estimate of civilian impact deaths, 3,100, high estimate, 3,600, it's conservative. What that's basically saying is that every bomb which misses kills only one person. Come on. A bomb misses in downtown Kandahar, it's not going to kill one person. The actual numbers are, of course, much, much higher.
Professor Mark Harold of the University of New Hampshire. Building Up for Peace, the voices and lyrics of many artists and singers are instrumental in the effort to stop the war against Iraq before it starts, as we hear in this piece prepared by Reem Kathuda from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington.
In this war against the war, all weapons are used. Humor, speeches, teachings, spoken word, poetry, music and songs. Work by people who call themselves activists, artists. Sarah Thompson is such an activist and a songwriter. Her inspiration, she says, comes from speaking out about social change movements and a connection to the earth.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Freedom or our comfort and convenience? Is it a profit for big business we pledge our allegiance? Are we prisoners in the land of the brave and the bold, held by indifference or hearts grown hard and cold? And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight. As the innocent die, you rulers carry the shame. And if we stand idly by, we share in the blame. And oh, America, do we care? Oh, America, are we aware? Who's dying for our comfort in this land? Who pays the cost for the convenience we demand? Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight.
It is for freedom. A song written after hearing the stories told by U.S. citizens who have traveled to Iraq to bring food and medicine and bear witness to the suffering sustained by the U.S. foreign policy, as she writes in her album.
Most of the reaction I got was from people in the movement, the peace movement here in northern Minnesota, and they were just very grateful for that song. I originally wrote it even earlier than 99. I wrote it after some folks from the community here went to Iraq on a Voices in the Wilderness trip to view the effect of the sanctions on the Iraqi people. And so I wrote it after they had come back and sharing their stories. And the title kind of, it just asks the questions of why are we having these sanctions, especially now it's become relevant with our move towards making a strike against Iraq.
How effective do you think is the role of a musician in the social justice movement in the United States?
It's vital in getting information across in a way that people might not hear it in a speech or in the information that we're just overloaded with. I think music and the arts are just vital to social movements, to inspire people to move, not just be overwhelmed with the issues. I think art has a way to touch us and really speak to our hearts and souls in a way that goes beyond the information we're just overwhelmed with.
What do you see yourself doing in this build-up against a build-up of war on Iraq?
Singing out. Singing out as much as I can, leading people in song at rallies, at the vigils that are happening across the nation. And I think that only builds the movement and helps people to just have the courage to take the step to say no to this war.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I am Reem Katkhuda.
In today's segment of spiritual and religious responses to the impending war against Iraq, the Administrative Board of the United States Catholic Conference sent President Bush a letter outlining why going to war against Saddam Hussein and the people of Iraq goes against the teachings of the Catholic Church. Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of the Catholic Archdiocese of Detroit refers to the Christian theological framework that dates back for 1,700 years, which determines how Christians decide if a war is just.
It starts with the presumption that you may not go to war, that war is something wrong, it's evil. And you may not go to war unless you have moral certitude that conditions are met. And the very first condition is that the nation choosing to go to war must be going to war in a defensive strategy, that you have to be defending yourself from an attack or from what is an imminent attack, if it hasn't actually started, that it's imminently going to start very, very, very soon and certain. Now, in this present situation, we're not under attack, and there clearly is no imminent attack that Iraq could put up against the United States right now. And so that's the first condition. But then as you go further down the line, there are such things as the proportionality, that you're confident that more good will be achieved than the evil done by the war. And here's where you have to take into consideration things like, well, what are going to be the civilian deaths? Now, how many innocent people are going to be killed if you go to war? And again, in this particular situation, if it means an invasion of a bombing of Baghdad, then an invasion of Baghdad, a city of 5 million people, you're going to have extraordinarily high numbers of civilian casualties.
Well, the Bush administration justifies its going to war. They have identified Iraqi President Saddam Hussein as a part of the axis of evil. And now I've heard you mention evil a couple of times in your response. Does that not make this war qualify, since Saddam Hussein?
No, frankly, because when you name someone an axis of evil, that doesn't automatically say that that nation or that person is undertaking an attack against you. You have to have some evidence that an attack is taking place, or is imminent and certain.
And the administration has said that they want, and Congress has given the administration the authority to launch a preemptive strike because
that's not any place within the just war theology. To preemptive strikes that's aggression, then. That's not defense.
Would it be part of the Catholic tradition for a mandate of sort to be issued from, I would assume, the Pope with regard to this war and to how Catholics should respond to this?
The Pope has already made his position clear. It's his judgment that it would not be justified. He condemned the first Persian Gulf War, and everything he said about that war, making it an unjust war, is true of this war if it were to happen. And so he's already made his judgment, but each person has to make his or her own judgment. I mean, the theology is based on looking at the facts, using the criteria, making a judgment, and then you have a responsibility in your conscience, the person making that judgment, to follow it. And if your judgment is that this war is not justified, then you must act to stop it in whatever way you can. And so the Pope doesn't issue a decree saying every Catholic must get out on the street and stop the war. But the Pope and the bishops do try to teach what those conditions are and ask people to be very conscientious in trying to apply them and then act on the judgment that they make.
You yourself, Bishop Gumbleton, have been quite active. I know that you've participated in trips to Baghdad through the Voices in Wilderness campaign, have you not?
Yes. Six times I've been over there.
How much of an impression has that made on you?
Well, a major impression from talking with people in various parts of the country. Seeing what the last war did to the country and how it's never had a chance to rebuild. And so you have people in Iraq who are living in extreme poverty, lacking sufficient food. Over 50% of the people have no access to clean water. They don't have the medical facilities and the medicines that they need to treat people. You have a country where in the southern part of it especially there's an extraordinary high incidence of cancer that has all happened since the war, and that seems to be because of the radioactive debris that was left from the weapons we used, which included missiles tipped with uranium, which is a radioactive metal.
In fact, I'm looking at pictures right here before me of the children that were born with extreme birth defects and deformity as a result of those depleted uranium ammunitions that were used.
Well, the people will say you can't prove that, but that's like the tobacco company saying you can't prove you got cancer because you smoked. You know, it happened after you smoked, but you can't really prove that that was the reason. Well, I think the same thing, when you've got tons of radioactive debris in this area, and you suddenly see an increase in cancer, an increase in birth deformities, you have to say this is the likely cause.
As for the repressive, brutal political climate under Saddam Hussein, Bishop Gumbleton says the U.S. could help bring about regime change, but maintains that bombing and killing are not justified. Among the many who stand out for their courageous actions against the Vietnam War are Phil and Dan Berrigan. In 1968, the two Catholic priests shocked the Catholic Church and the American public with a series of high-profile raids on draft boards, and their resistance to U.S. militarism didn't stop with the end of the Vietnam War. Phil Berrigan has spent over 11 years of his life in prison for acts of civil disobedience and symbolic disarmament of nuclear weapons. Last weekend, Peace Watch producers Laurel Padgett-Seekins and Scott Gurian asked Phil what parallels he sees between a war on Iraq and the Vietnam conflict.
The Vietnam War, with the exception of the Aussies and New Zealanders to an extent, and the South Koreans, lacked international support. So we went in there, for the most part, unilaterally. That's one situation. Now Bush has gotten reluctant support from a whole slew of satellite stations or countries surrounding the Persian Gulf. And he's still trying to get France and Russia to fall in line. And meanwhile, of course, the people of this country are slowly waking up and slowly declaring their opposition to this war. If war breaks out in Iraq, it will be of the same caliber as the type we waged in Vietnam. That is total war. And I mean by that, you totalize the assault on not only the combatants of the army and the air force of Iraq, but also civilian population, the infrastructure, the soil, the water, the air. You assault the whole environment. And we will certainly use depleted uranium again, as we used it in the first Iraqi war and in Bosnia and Yugoslavia against the Serbs.
What can the current movement against the war in Iraq learn from lessons of anti-war movement against the Vietnam War?
Well, in the Vietnam War, there was strong elements of civil disobedience, and that's almost totally lacking today. And I mean by that draft resistors, young guys who refuse to fight, and I mean by that... some who fled to Canada or Sweden or France, and others who did these scores, or maybe over 100 draft board raids against Selective Service. And then many of them, myself included, stood by for arrest and went to jail. I did 40 months over Catonsville. So that's largely lacking today. And we found by experience that as the situation grows more critical, people begin to ask deeper and deeper questions about what their responsibilities are.
If you could explain really briefly what the Catonsville action was.
We went into this draft board, local draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, had the place all scoped out. Knew what we were dealing with by way of clerks, went in there with a firm conviction we couldn't hurt anybody, and we assigned ourselves tasks. One would watch the clerks and prevent them from calling the police. One would loot the 1A draft files and pile them into wire trash burners that we brought along. One would interpose themselves from the remaining two or three clerks and prevent them from stopping the action. So everybody had a job. So it only took us about, I'd say, maybe 10 minutes. And we got everything we needed, and And we took them to the parking lot. We burned these draft files with homemade napalm and made it known to the press that we were doing that, and then waited for arrest.
In my study of history, it seems like the Catonsville Nine action was one of the decisive actions against the Vietnam War, and that it sort of sparked a lot of debate within particularly the religious community in the United States. And sort of in the absence of the draft right now, what do you see as some comparable place that we could target to wake people up again now?
I don't know, Laurel. You're speaking about a catalytic action, huh? Yeah, I don't know at this point. Maybe it will have to be some American bodies coming back from Iraq.
Last Saturday, over 100,000 people gathered to protest at a giant anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. I believe over 10,000 in Minneapolis, tens of thousands in other places like San Francisco, Seattle, and all around the country and around the world. Are you hopeful of the growing anti-war movement?
I'm very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful. Because, you know, we all experienced 9/11, and we did realize the plurality that Bush had by way of support. And we did see the country go crazy with flags and all of that. Well, now a lot of that is being taken back. And people are beginning to, in a very sobering and responsible way, they're beginning to rock back on their heels and say, there's something fishy about this.
Is there any final thoughts you'd like to add?
Well, I must say this, that under the aegis of all of this, under the heading of all of this, there's very little being said about preemptive nuclear strike and about nuclear weapons in general. And the lengths to which we're willing to go in order to fund this. And as far as I can discover, we're willing to go well into the trillions to fund this. And this is never talked about. It's never talked about. That's why Pacifica and stations like yours are doing such key work, because you open up questions like these.
Noted activist and author Phil Berrigan talking to Laurel Padgett-Seekins and Scott Gurian. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian, engineered by Granger Helvey, consultants Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Special thanks this evening to Ann Alquist of KFAI for production assistance with the Wellstone segment. We had web help from Pete Caracas and RadioForAll.net, as well as WebActive.com. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or you can visit the website at www.pacificaarchives.org. Please email us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.